WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, teenage pregnancy. It might be more of a symptom than a cause of poverty. We'll look at some of the common misconceptions about teenage pregnancy with sociologist Kristen Luker, author of Dubious Conceptions, The Politics of Teenage Pregnancy. Also, Mother Said, Hal Sirowitz reads and talks about his poems, which are based on the advice he was given by his obsessive, overprotective, and hypercritical mother. He's read his poems on MTV and at the Lollapalooza Festival. And Ken Tucker reviews the latest Wallace and Gromit animated short. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Defense Secretary William Perry says President Clinton has nominated Admiral Jay Johnson to be the new Navy chief. He would replace Admiral Jeremy Mike Borda, who committed suicide last month. Perry, who's traveling in Lisbon, Portugal, told reporters that Johnson will be an outstanding chief of naval operations. Johnson's name will now be forwarded to the Senate for confirmation. The European Commission has decided to ease its world ban on British beef exports after a bitter campaign by the British Prime Minister, John Major. The Commission's agreed to allow Britain to resume sales of beef derivatives, but the ban on beef for human consumption stands. Michael Moran reports from London.
The European Commission went a long way toward defusing the crisis over British beef with today's ruling. Major's government has taken a terrible political beating since the crisis over mad cow disease began in March. The European Union imposed the ban when new evidence suggested that the disease, normally confined to animals, might be affecting humans. Indeed, in the past year, more than a dozen Britons have died of a related ailment. But the export ban transformed the beef crisis into a threat to European unity, prompting Britain to obstruct all European business until the ban was eased. Even after today, Major can't claim total victory. Germany has pledged to continue barring British beef products, saying only a scientific and not a political solution will suffice. For National Public Radio, I'm Michael Moran in London.
The estranged husband of Utah Congresswoman Enid Green pleaded guilty to 4 fraud charges today. Joseph Waldholz admitted violating federal election laws involving Enid Green's 1994 campaign. He'll cooperate in the continuing investigation as part of his plea deal. Major League Baseball's executive council is meeting in Philadelphia to consider suspending Cincinnati Reds owner Marge Schott. Her recent public comments and management of the Reds franchise are at issue. NPR's Mark Schramm reports.
Marge Schott has been her own worst enemy this season. In recent interviews, she's made positive comments about Adolf Hitler and disparaging remarks about Asian Americans. When umpire John McSherry collapsed and died on the field at Riverfront Stadium on opening day, she questioned why the game should be postponed. These comments created a public relations nightmare for the league, but the executive council is also concerned about Schott's running of the ball club. Schott has severely cut back on the Reds' scouting and minor league systems. Earlier this year, she canceled the wire service that showed out-of-town scores on the Riverfront scoreboard. If the council suspends Schott, it won't be the first time. She was suspended for the entire 1993 season for using racial and ethnic slurs. I'm Mark Schramm in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 1.5 at 5,664. Trading is active. This is NPR. 6,700 machinists at McDonnell Douglas are on strike in St. Louis. Union workers want to restrain the aircraft maker's use of farming out work to subcontractors and non-union plants. Union officials say they can't stand by and watch their jobs evaporate. But McDonnell Douglas says there's only so much it can do to guarantee workers' jobs. A spokesman says the company has offered job guarantees to 5,000 workers, but that is the limit. No new talks are scheduled. McDonnell Douglas says production will go on with non-unionized workers. A new report finds the substance abuse gender gap is closing. It says women are drinking and using drugs nearly as much as men. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
According to the report, the percentage of drug addicts who are women doubled between 1960 and the late 1970s. It says today about 40% of crack addicts are women. The report also found that girls now are 15 times more likely than their mothers to begin using illegal drugs during adolescence. The research for the report discovered that there is little understanding about a woman's motivations and drug treatment needs. Joseph Califano is president of the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University, which issued the report. Califano says they've been doing research on substance abuse as though everybody was a man. He adds it's clear that women need different treatment. Former First Lady Betty Ford will be in attendance at a luncheon later today when the report is formally released. Mrs. Ford is calling for the expansion of treatment opportunities for women. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
There are new calls for Israeli Prime Minister-elect Benjamin Netanyahu to form a unity government. The Israeli Supreme Court has upheld last week's voting, which gave Netanyahu the win by less than 1 percentage point. A Netanyahu supporter is suggesting the Likud premier should consider a coalition with the Labor Party. David Levy, a Likud member, says an alliance with the Labor Party would help Israel in peace talks and with foreign relations. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Advanta, a financial services provider to consumers and small businesses and sponsor of the upcoming Cezanne documentary on public television. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Kristen Luker has written a new book that challenges a lot of preconceptions about teenage pregnancy in America. She fears that current social policies, as well as new liberal and conservative proposals, are based on a misunderstanding of the problem. Luker's new book is called Dubious Conceptions, The Politics of Teenage Pregnancy. Her previous book is titled Abortion and the Politics of Motherhood. Luker says most Americans would probably be surprised to learn that the rate of teenage pregnancies in America has stayed pretty constant through the century. I asked her if that's the case, why does it seem that more teenagers are pregnant now?
I think there are a couple of reasons. First of all, it's more visible. When in the 60s, when people were having babies, they dropped out of school, not necessarily because they wanted to, but because they had to. So you didn't see teenage girls pregnant in the public arena in the way that you do now. They went back to their homes and they were just kind of ignored. Secondly, they are unmarried, but as I say, they have a lot of company in our society. And in fact, the bulk of unwed mothers are not teenagers. And thirdly, and I think this is the most important part, who becomes a teenage mother has changed pretty dramatically. And I think at some level people intuit that. In the 60s and 70s and the 50s, for that matter, most American women were teenage mothers or close to it. Most women had their babies pretty early, their first babies pretty early in life. What we're seeing now in American society is a real bifurcation of when people have babies. Poor people continue to have babies in the traditional pattern, that is young, and well-to-do people are increasingly postponing their babies till their 30s, their 40s, and in some cases, their 50s. So I think all of those things have created a perception that there's more of it and it's more troublesome.
You, in your book, compare the attitude of many liberals and conservatives to teenage pregnancy. And about liberals, you say they think that the problem is a lack of information. If adults just tell teenagers more clearly what they should do and why, they'll do it. If we just make more information available about contraception and childbirth and so on. What do you think of that?
Despite everybody's stereotypes to the contrary, kids are using contraception more often, they're using it better, and they're using it sooner. The problem is it's mostly affluent kids who are doing that. That, in fact, what we've had is a sexual revolution among white middle-class kids who are now sexually active but not getting pregnant. Those policies, however, haven't really affected these very poor kids who are continuing to get pregnant and have babies in a pattern that was traditional up until fairly recently for everybody in the society.
Why do you think that this hasn't affected poor teenagers?
I think the reason is that poor teenagers don't have a lot to lose by getting pregnant. And I sometimes think the pregnancy for a poor young woman is kind of like a lottery ticket, which is it doesn't cost you very much if you lose, and at least it gives you the dream of hitting the jackpot. And one of the things, Terry, that I found very amazing as I've interviewed young women and as I've looked at other people's interviews with young women is a lot of young mothers will say, it's the best thing I ever did. You know, it made me go back to school for my baby. It made me get a job for my baby. I didn't want my baby to have a dropout for a mother. I was running with a rough crowd, and I didn't want my baby to have a druggie for a mother. And part of what I think is poignant about this issue and what we really should be worrying about is that these young women can't really be effective on their own behalves, but as soon as they have a baby, then they can be proactive and effective on behalf of the baby, that the baby really does change their lives.
You say that poor teenagers feel like they really have nothing to lose mm-hmm. by pregnancy. But on the other hand, I mean, you could really argue, and most people do argue, that teenage pregnancy helps lead to a more difficult life. It's unlikely that the mother will finish school. It's less likely she'll have job training, therefore less likely that she'll have a job that pays an adequate amount.
Well, what's interesting is that is the conventional wisdom. And it's certainly the wisdom that came out. One of the ironies of teenage pregnancy is that as an issue on the American public policy horizon is that it was an issue put there by liberals. And what liberals said was young women who become mothers in an untimely fashion become poor. They end up shackling themselves to their babies and they end up poorer than they would otherwise be. One of the serious questions that I think we're debating now in public policy circles is how much poorer are these kids than they would otherwise be? Because most of them by class background are going to be poor to begin with. And it turns out that the evidence that teenage pregnancy makes you a lot poorer than you would otherwise be is pretty flimsy. One being this question of pre-existing poverty. It turns out that the other thing, and these aren't, you know, it's hard sorting this out because these are covered in different kinds of databases. The kinds of people, even among poor kids, who become teenage mothers are people who are not succeeding in other arenas. They're kids who are having trouble in school. They're kids who are having absenteeism and truancy. And it's not at all clear. I think the most that we could say at this point is that being a teenage mother might make you a little poorer than you would otherwise be, but it doesn't condemn you to a life of poverty that you wouldn't otherwise have. And I should say, by the way, I think that's why teenage mothers are getting demonized right now, is that we're terribly concerned about poverty, that the life is getting harder for poor people in our country. I think that teenage mothers have been caught up in the debate on welfare, and we believe that somehow they're responsible for their own poverty.
Now, you've talked a little bit about your critique of the liberal point of view on teenage pregnancy. Let's look at the conservative point of view. You characterize that as being this, that conservatives often feel that teenage pregnancy is a problem of incentives and controls. If adults just cut off teens' allowance or welfare or whatever and limit their access to those privileges that society has under its control, then teens will stand up and do the right thing. What's your critique of that?
Well, my main critique is we've actually had a natural experiment on this, which is over the last 20 years, the actual value of welfare has gone down dramatically because it's not indexed to inflation. And if this theory is correct, we should have seen a dramatic dropping of teenage pregnancy as the real value of welfare went down. And the fact of the matter is we didn't see that. And finally, we have probably the skimpiest safety net in America, in this country, compared to any other industrialized country that I know of. And we have the highest rate of teenage motherhood. So there's no clear connection, and I think this has been demonstrated many, many times, between welfare and the rates of teen motherhood.
Now, welfare and welfare for teenage mothers has been the subject of enormous debate for the past couple of years.
Absolutely, yes.
Still being debated. You write that there are certain harsh realities for teenagers that make it hard for many of them to give up welfare. What are those realities?
Well, there is a proliferation of low-wage jobs in our society that have no benefits. And as a number of critics have pointed out, it's just very, very difficult to have a low-wage job with no benefits and support yourself. You get no health care. You still are below the poverty line. Many of these jobs have no upward mobility. It's not as though you come in as a minimum wage worker and work yourself up to a living wage. That, you know, they're very flat jobs in terms of the wage structure. And I think that's the core of the problem, that we're living through this global economic transformation where there are a few really good jobs at the top for highly educated people, and then an increasing number of low-wage, low-benefit, or no-benefit jobs at the bottom. And we blame teenagers for getting themselves into a fix that we think somehow is related to when they get pregnant, as opposed to these global changes in the economy.
And so often, say, a teenage girl who's pregnant, her boyfriend or her husband might actually have a job, but it might be a job, the kind of job you're talking about, a minimum wage job with no chance of improvement.
Exactly right. And one of the things that I discovered, again, talking to teenagers and looking at some aggregate data we have, a lot of these fathers are much more involved than people think. That we think unmarried means disengaged. And in fact, one of the surprising things I found was that, drawing on the work of Sarah McClanahan, that unmarried fathers see their kids more often than divorced fathers who've remarried. So many of these men are very involved in their kids' lives and are trying to participate in raising the kids. And many of them actually are cohabiting with the mother. But the real problem is they don't have health care. They don't make a living wage. If they get married, in most states, they're not eligible for AFDC. So there's a set of what the economists would call perverse incentives that sort of make it very hard for women to get off welfare.
So what do you recommend? They're doing away with the incentives?
No, in fact, and here's the very hard problem. This is the hard nut of the welfare debate, which is that the dirty little secret about welfare as we know it is that it's the cheapest outcome that we have. I mean, it's the cheapest way of keeping women and children off the streets. Any other alternative, we have to go one of two ways. We have to spend real money, health care, a national health care system, job training, daycare, having the government be an employer of last resort. That's real money. Or we have to totally abandon any responsibility for poor men and women and their children and just say, well, we'll live with more homeless men and women and children. We'll live with more hungry children. Yeah, and the sad thing about this is I think it's very clear which direction public policy is going. Both Dole and Clinton are competing with each other to see who can be harder on poor men, women, and children. So I think the state of poor kids and poor families is going to get a lot worse.
If you're just joining us, my guest is sociologist Kristen Luker, and her new book is called Dubious Conceptions, The Politics of Teenage Pregnancy. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kristen Luker, author of the new book Dubious Conceptions, The Politics of Teenage Pregnancy. In your book, you look at some of the reasons why teenage girls often don't use contraception. You point out that a lot of pregnancies come about the first time a teenage girl has sex, and that there's a lot of social pressures on that teenage girl to not come prepared to that occasion with contraception. Well, let me ask you to explain.
One of the things that I found, again, talking to people and looking at other people's interviews with young women, is that what you need to do to be a good girl, even in these liberated times, is totally at odds with what you need to be a good contraceptor. I mean, in order to use contraception, you have to think of yourself as going to have sex. You have to plan ahead. You have to talk to a young man about your sexuality. You have to, in a way, own your own sexuality in a fairly forthright way. And you have to put your own well-being ahead of a man's comfort or pleasure. And none of those are skills that we encourage in young women. And it's when a young woman has a lot of other resources going for her, when she has high self-esteem and she's doing well in school and she, you know, a lot of things in her life are clicking, sometimes and surprisingly often now for affluent kids, she can bring these resources to bear. But for kids who are kind of, having trouble in life, it's very hard to do that kind of planning and, thinking ahead. And one of the things that I was really struck by, again, in talking to teenagers is the extent to which it's almost hard to use the word decision in terms of becoming a teenage mother, which is they kind of think about contraception, but the boy kind of doesn't want to use it, and they don't really want to talk about it, and they kind of have sex for a while, and then they kind of get pregnant, and then they think about an abortion, but the boy really doesn't want to have an abortion, or someone's mother doesn't approve of abortion, and they kind of drift into pregnancy.
Some states are tightening their statutory rape laws.
Yes.
And this is the logic behind it, that they're saying that a lot of teenage mothers become pregnant with older men who are 20 or considerably older than that. What do you think of tightening the statutory rape laws? And you might want to explain a little bit more about the logic behind this.
Well, the logic is that, in fact, as you suggest, teenaged women often have partners who are not teenaged men. And the new proposal is that we tighten the statutory rape laws in order to arrest and incarcerate these so-called predatory men. I have a lot of trouble with that. And I think what's happened is that, first, we've demonized young women. You know, we see them as causing their own poverty by getting pregnant. And now we're taking the next step and demonizing young men. It turns out, in fact, that most teenagers have partners who are pretty close in age to their own age. So it's not surprising that the bulk of fathers of the babies of teenaged women are in their 20s. So I think that this is not to say there aren't predatory men out there, because I'm sure there are. But I think, taken overall, what this is an attempt to another quick fix, I think, to the teenage pregnancy problem. You know, as I say, both liberals think, well, we just need more contraception and sex education, but that hasn't really worked. Conservatives say just cut off welfare, but in fact we're cutting off welfare and that hasn't worked. So now there's this new theory, which unfortunately is attractive to both liberals and conservatives alike, which is it's the men. Let's just lock up these predatory men. And I think once again this will fail because I don't think that the bulk of young men are in fact these predatory, exploitative older men who are taking advantage of young women. It's a much more diffuse and in some ways it's the egalitarianism of poverty. You know, Marion Wright Edelman said something very astute many years ago, which is that hope is the best contraceptive. And we live in a society where hope is rapidly being withdrawn from young men and young women on the bottom tier of our society. And it shouldn't surprise us that they're kind of drifting towards pregnancy for that same reason we talked about earlier. At least there's a chance that something might change.
Did your research change your mind about anything? Or, you know, were you surprised by any of your findings?
I guess, yes. There were two things that I changed my mind on. One was very young women, that is women under 15. Their numbers are very small. They make up less than 2% of all teenage mothers. But I think there is real reason to worry about them. They're poorer than even teenage mothers as a whole. They're much more likely to report their sexuality as coercive sexuality. And they're much more likely to seem to have physical problems even once you take into account their pre-existing poverty. So I think it probably is right, even though, as I say, the numbers are really quite small and haven't changed much since the 1960s, I think that probably we should spend more effort worrying about the 12-year-olds and the 13-year-olds and the 14-year-olds than I think we have. The other thing was that one of the things I came to realize is that the worry about teenage pregnancy is only one half of the coin. The other half is elderly pregnancy, that as we have a society in which more and more women are postponing pregnancy later and later and later, we have a public policy problem there that people don't really see as connected to teenage pregnancy. But the so-called infertility crisis that you see on every news magazine or that you hear talked about among all your friends is simply the flip side of the teenage pregnancy problem, that there's never a good time to have a baby in American society because there's never any real support for combining a baby with paid labor. So you find affluent women waiting until they are pretty sure they're well established in their careers. One of the problems, of course, is first they have infertility problems, which are often very expensive. And funnily enough, they often have problems with their babies being at risk from prematurity and low birth weight and all those things that we worry about with teenagers. We ignore those problems in affluent women because affluent women have insurance, but taking care of triplets that are born 2 months too early because the mother has used infertility treatments is just as surely socially subsidized as is the low birth weight baby of a 15-year-old. And yet we worry about the latter in ways that we don't worry about the former.
Socially subsidized in the sense that everybody ends up paying for it in their insurance premiums?
Exactly right. Exactly right.
We have about a minute left, and in that minute I'm going to ask you to squeeze in the answer to this question. Do you see any connections in what you found in your abortion book, in which you examined the abortion debate, and what you found in this new book about the politics of teenage pregnancy?
Yes, I think there are connections, and that is that women and their bodies become the focus of a whole set of inchoate concerns that Americans bring about marriage, about sexuality, about the family, about the economy. And it's as if women and their sexuality and their reproductive patterns become a lightning rod for all those other anxieties. So when we begin to think about public policy and when we think about what we think we know about abortion or what we think we know about teenagers and their babies, it's very important to be skeptical because I think more often than not, what we have is a, if you will, a national psychodrama being played out rather than a clear look at what the real costs are and what the demographic realities are.
Kristen Luker, I thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Terry.
Kristen Luker's new book is called Dubious Conceptions, The Politics of Teenage Pregnancy. She teaches sociology and law at the University of California at Berkeley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Don't stick your finger in the ketchup bottle. Don't stick your arm out the window. Don't wear underwear with holes in it. That's the kind of advice Hal Sirowitz got from his mother when he was growing up. He'll read from and talk about his new book of poems, Mother Said. And Ken Tucker reviews a new Wallace and Gromit animated short. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Poets sometimes say their writing comes from a voice in their heads. The voice in Hal Sirowitz's head is often that of his overprotective, hypercritical mother. His new book, Mother Said, collects the poems he's written about the advice she used to give him. At the age of 47, Sirowitz may still be a mama's boy, but his mother poems have brought him to hip venues like MTV's Spoken Word Unplugged and the alternative rock event, the Lollapalooza Festival. For the past 15 years, he's taught special education in Queens, New York. We invited Hal Sirowitz to read and talk about his mother poems. This one is called Chopped Off Arm.
Don't stick your arm out of the window, mother said. Another car can sneak up behind us and chop it off. Then your father will have to stop. Stick the severed piece in the trunk and drive you to the hospital. It's not like the part of your telescope that snaps back on. A doctor will have to sew it. You won't be able to wear short sleeves. You won't want anyone to see the stitches.
When did you write this poem?
I wrote it about 7-8 years ago. I was with a girlfriend. We were going to Jones Beach, and we were stuck in traffic. And while sitting next to her, I just stuck my arm out of the window, and I heard my mother's advice in my head, and I pulled my arm back into the car, and I just pulled out a sheet of paper and just wrote the poem right there. And the girlfriend actually would have preferred for me to write a poem about her. But, I mean, I couldn't. I just had to write about my mother. She was my muse.
How did you start writing these mother poems?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer, but I never knew what to write about. My life wasn't that interesting. I stayed home a lot. I was a little of a bookworm. And I thought, you know, I wrote about myself, like who would be interested in my life. But then all of a sudden it came to me, I had this really interesting mother. So I started writing about her, and it started appealing to a lot of people, and I was getting very good reactions. And my highest compliment is when someone goes up to me and says, hey, we must have had the same mother.
I know you've read a lot of poetry slams, and poetry slams strike me as being readings where a lot of people write very kind of street-oriented or street-wise kind of poems. And it's something of a combination between, like, you know, a hip-hop scene and a poetry scene. And so I can imagine here you are reading all these poems about your overprotective mother at these poetry slams. That must have been so odd.
Yeah, I mean, people didn't quite know what to make of me at first, but then they started laughing with the poems, and I started winning them over. You know, at first, I was this odd person out there, but, you know, I'm used to that role.
Of being odd?
Yeah. Yeah, somewhat odd. Well, I grew up having the speech problem. I used to be a stutterer. I couldn't say certain words well, so I always felt that I was this slight outsider. And which is one of the reasons why I became a writer. You know, I'm witnessing my life, talking about my life.
Let me ask you to read another poem from your book, Mother Said. And this is called Emergency Situation.
I threw out your blue underwear, Mother said. It had a hole in it. No son of mine will ever be caught wearing that. It's a reflection on me. It makes me look bad. I know no one can see it, but you can't be sure. Let's say you break your leg. You're rushed to the hospital. The nurse takes off your pants. She'll see it. The doctor may not even put on a cast because he'll think you come from a poor family. I didn't bring you up to embarrass me. When you were little, I dressed you up as a girl. You were gorgeous. You had curls hanging over your face. But let's be honest, you're no longer cute. You're too old to get away with anything.
Is that how she would talk to you?
Yeah, she would talk to me like that. She was pretty tough. Well, I was very important to her. I was the only son, and she expected great things from me. Like, she wanted me to be either a doctor or a lawyer. My mother, her mother died when she was 5 years old, and so I think she had this tremendous need to be this perfect mother.
Did she dress you as a girl?
Oh, only when I was very little, I think one or two times. So, I mean, I wasn't in the cross-dressing, anything like that.
Right. You know, what really strikes me about the advice she gives you, on the one hand, she seems to really want the best for you and want you to be happy. On the other hand, she's always so critical in the poems, critical of what you're saying and how you look and how you dress. It's really quite insulting.
Well, it's filled with love, too. And I can never write a Hallmark card to my mother. And these poems are about the truth. It's the truth about our relationship. And I think a lot of people have similar relationships, like, you know, they love their mother, but then mothers aren't always easy. Even though they love you, they want the best for you. And also, in these poems, it's like she's protecting me from the future. And so she has to be very harsh, and it's very hard to protect someone from what hasn't happened yet.
Were you what would be described by your mother as a good son or a good kid?
Yeah, she kept drumming it into me that I should be nice. So I was a good boy. I would listen to her a lot. My older sister was more of a rebel. Like, she would always be fighting my mother. But I could never really fight her. I just listened to her. So I didn't always listen to her all the time, which is obvious from the poem. She has to keep reprimanding me. So the way I dealt with my mother is that I wouldn't do things right. Like, I wouldn't talk back. But if she told me to make the bed, I wouldn't make the bed right. So then she had to unmake the bed again and remake it. So I would do things like that.
There's another poem I want you to read from your book, Mother Said, and this is called Declaration.
If John F. Kennedy can take his mother to his inauguration, Mother said, and not feel ashamed when she puts her arm around him, then how come you don't want to be seen with me on the street? He's the commander-in-chief of the entire country, and you're not even in charge of your room. I have to clean it for you. I never heard anyone call him a sissy for hanging around his mother, and even if someone did, it wouldn't bother him because he knows it's not true. You never told me to get lost when I was putting on your diapers. Mothers are the most maligned group in this country. As soon as their children get big enough, they pretend that they don't know us anymore.
Now, were there places where she would accompany you that you really didn't want her around?
She would make me do things. Like, she would make me go to the cemetery with her and visit her dead mother. And, you know, I wanted to just play baseball with my friends. And while my friends were having a lot of fun going to dances and doing things like that, I was going shopping with my mother and visiting the cemetery. And at first I resented it, but then when I got older, I realized I got all this great material out of my mother.
Did your mother ever come to one of your readings?
No, she never did. She never knew I was a writer. I was a little afraid to tell her that I was a poet, and I thought she might smack me on the head. The thing was that she was always, I thought that if I told her, she might think I was this, I would become this crazy wild beatnik poet. Because, you know, I'm a teacher, and my mother was someone who felt you can only do one thing well in life. And so if she knew I was doing two things, I don't think she would have been pleased.
So she never read any of your poems about her?
No, she never did. I think she would be very sensitive, and I think she would have said, well, I didn't really say this, I said that. And so I never quite showed them to her, but I wasn't writing for her particularly. I wasn't writing to please her. I was trying to write the truth about our relationship. And I also felt if I showed it to her, then I would worry about what she thought. And so it was better by not showing to her. I was able to write the truth.
There must have been so much about you that your mother didn't know, if she didn't know something as fundamental as the fact that you were a writer.
Well, I learned early on that the less I told her, the less she would criticize me about. And so I hardly told her anything about my life. When I was young, I would like tell her things, but I could never impress her. So I found that if I told her less, I would get in less trouble. And life's a little like that, too, where you get very close to someone, let's say if you're married or have this strong connection, that person can see a lot of your different sides. But then certain people can only see one or two sides. And my mother always saw me as though I was living in the past. And sometimes when I would visit her, even though I was 30, 40, I felt like I was still 13, I was still 14. And a few times I wanted to shout out, hey, mother, I'm not 13 anymore. But I knew I just couldn't do that. Like, she wouldn't have understood.
Let me ask you to do another poem from your new book, Mother Said, and this is called Living at Home.
It's impossible for your parents to take you to court, my therapist said, and sue you for the money they spent buying you shoes. The law states that they had to provide for you. So if they tell you they want you to reimburse them for all the pants they had to buy you, don't tell them to sue you, because that'll be confrontational. You should just humor them and say that when you get a job, you'll send them checks in the mail. Don't tell them how much you're going to give them. The way to avoid a crisis is to always speak in general terms. You can get specific after you leave the house.
When did you start going to therapy?
In college. And so in some ways, by going to a therapist, I had a second mother, because my mother at home was slightly critical, and then my therapist was slightly supportive. So I had, like, mother number one, mother number two. And my real mother didn't like my adopted mother.
What was your mother's attitude toward therapy? Did she think that you were going there just to complain about her?
Yeah, that's what she thought I was doing all the time. And she also thought I was just telling bad things about her, that I wasn't telling all the good things she did for me, like buying me ice cream and taking me to Broadway with her and doing nice things.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more and hear more of your poems. My guest is Hal Sarowitz. His new book of poems is called Mother Said. This is Fresh Air. Back with Hal Sarowitz, a poet who mostly writes poems about his mother, his late mother. Now, I know you teach special education now in New York City.
Right.
How old are the children?
They range ages 5 to 10. And I like my job a lot because I identify with my students. And because some of them are outsiders too. Like, they don't quite fit into regular school. They have special needs. And I felt that way too. Growing up, like, I knew it was quietly, I was different because of the way that I talked, and it made me feel almost like this outsider. And teaching really helps me a lot because when I work with the kids, I smell the glue that we use, and all of a sudden it just brings back these memories of when I was little. And so in some ways I'm redeeming my past, like I'm helping these kids, and it just helps me. Also, it helps me as a writer because when I work with these students, I can't assume anything. I can't assume that they know anything. And then in other ways, I have to be like my mother, too. I have to keep warning them not to do this, not to do that. So it makes me be at peace with my mother because I become almost like a mother.
Well, that's exactly what I was wondering about, you know, because you do have to be the parental figure when you're teaching. And these are kids, if it's special education, who particularly need structure. And someone to kind of explain where the boundaries are?
Yes, that's what I do. I always set limits, and I never get upset with them. And if they get upset, I just wait for them to calm down. I just talk with them and give them choices. And it's really helpful for me being a teacher because when I read, sometimes there's a few hundred people, and I get all this applause and recognition. And then sometimes it can go to your head, but then when I go to my class, I have maybe 10 students, and they run around the room. I can't even control 10 students sometimes. So it's a real humbling experience. So it's real helpful to me to work with students like that.
No, I believe your mother died about 2 years ago. Is that right?
Yes, close to three.
Did you feel very guilty when she died because you had kept this part of your writing a secret from her all her life?
Yeah, it was a hard choice to make, whether to show her my work or not. And while she was dying, I was thinking of showing it to her. But then I thought, you know, people, when they die, they don't transform themselves. They don't change. I just want to be there for my mother. So I would just see her a lot and hold her hands. I just didn't want to introduce something very strange.
That's true, which
her.
She might have never been able to understand. And she might have been very offended by the whole thing.
She might, you don't know. Well, my father, you know, said that he feels my mother would really love my poetry and that she would like it a lot. So that's the standard I use.
So did that lead you and your father to have conversations that you never would have had before about your mother? Your poems, did that lead to conversations?
Well, what happened is he just kept telling me stories and stories about his life. He just wanted me to write about him, and he didn't want me to write about myself. He felt his life was even more interesting than me. And so whenever I saw him, he would just constantly tell me the same stories over and over again. But, you know, I would listen to these stories. And so I felt it made him feel better about himself, that it was almost like he felt important that what he said, his stories were going to be recorded, would find themselves in a poem.
I believe your father passed away just a few weeks ago. Very sorry to have heard about that. I think when he passed away, you were doing a lot of readings for your new book, and that must have been so strange for you because those poems are so personal and so much about your parents.
It was hard to do, but it was something that he wanted me to do. When while he was sick in the hospital, I would go to visit him, and he would tell me that I shouldn't be visiting him. I should just be working on my poems because I was making him famous, and so it was more important to him that I would write my poems and visit him. I would just visit him anyway, and I would spend a lot of hours with him at the hospital, and he would be taking pain medication, and then he would fall asleep, and I would just take out my notebook and write a poem about him, and then he would wake up, and I'd just put my notebook away. So we got very close at the end, and he was really proud of my writing and wanted me to keep writing and wanted me to go on tour and read my poems. And so it was hard, but I felt I was honoring my father. I was doing what he wanted me to do, and I was acknowledging his life so people would know about his life, because I felt both my mother and father were very smart, intelligent people, but they didn't have a voice. Like, no one quite knew who they were except for the few people they knew. And so my writing about their life is ways of giving their words of wisdom back to the world.
You know, your book of poems is so filled with advice that your mother gave you over the years. My guess is, if she knew that you were being interviewed a lot, the advice she would give you about the interviews is, don't tell them anything bad about me.
Definitely. But, you know, part of being a writer for me is that my life is public. And one reason I became a writer was I would talk to someone on the telephone, and my best conversation was after I hung up the phone. I would hang up the phone, I would just keep talking to the person inside my head, and I would come up with my best lines. And so even now that my mother's gone, you know, I'm still working out this conflict I had with her. I can still hear her yelling at me. And so things don't end when someone dies. Like, what I'm saying is that the mother, people important to you, they live inside your head. And they take a room in there almost, and you constantly hear them.
We have time for one more poem, and this time I'll ask you to choose one. Do you have a favorite you'd like to read?
You'll read the form finger. Don't stick your finger in the ketchup bottle, mother said. It might get stuck, and then you'll have to wait for your father to get home to pull it out. He won't be happy to find a dirty fingernail squirming in the ketchup that he's going to use on his hamburger. He'll yank it out so hard that for the rest of your life, you won't be able to wear a ring on that finger. And if you ever get a girlfriend and you hold hands, she's bound to ask you why one of your fingers is deformed. And you'll be obligated to tell her how you didn't listen to your mother and insisted on playing with the ketchup bottle. And she'll get to thinking, he probably won't listen to me either. And she'll push your hand away.
Have you ever been in a relationship with a woman who reminds you of your mother? And if and when that happens, what's your reaction?
Yeah, I've been in some relationships like that. I think it's just my personality. I don't talk back. I'm rather nice. You know, I was trained to be nice by my mother. So sometimes I'm in some relationships where my girlfriend is just very critical and tells me not to do this and not to do that, to fold the towels after I use them in the bathroom. And so what I do is I just don't fold them very well. And then I just eventually end up leaving. And, you know, like, the relationship just falls apart.
Do you plan to continue to write poems about your mother, or are you finding new subjects now?
Oh, no, I still continue to keep writing about her. But, you know, unlike other writers, you know, they want to keep getting better and better, but I don't want my mother to yell at me any better than she has already. So I just want to record our relationship and just work out more of what happened in our relationship. And life's a little like, as you get older, things you blocked out, you suddenly remember. And so I feel like I keep writing about my mother, even though she's not around, that the past is like this well. You could keep getting water from it like it never runs dry.
Hal Sierowitz, thank you so much for being with us and for reading some of your poems.
Oh, thank you.
Hal Sierowitz has a new book of poems called Mother Said. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the latest Wallace and Gromit animated short. This is Fresh Air. A movie theater near you may be showing something called The Best of Aardman Animation, a collection of short films from Britain. Since 1975, Aardman Animation has been a place for animators to experiment with forms of storytelling and image-making outside the usual confines of children's entertainment. The company's greatest success has been the films of Nick Park. Three of his short films have won Oscars. The latest, included in The Best of Aardman Animation, is A Close Shave. Ken Tucker has a review.
Nick Park is a 37-year-old Englishman who's one of the most successful artists alive. I mean that in this sense. Park has managed to do precisely what he wants creatively, has found an appreciative audience for his small-scale, intensely personal work, and has been recognized for it with rave reviews and major prizes. In the world of stop-action animation, Park is king. He's the creator of Wallace and Gromit, a gentle, quiet, middle-class man and his dog. Wallace speaks in a soft, hesitant tone. Gromit is usually taciturn and always silent. The dog is the smarter, more worldly of the two. He reads the newspaper while his master eats cheese and crackers. Wallace is the sort of amateur inventor who's always coming up with gadgets which are awfully clever, but which no one really needs. An automatic porridge dispenser, for example, or a pair of electronic pants. Nick Park built Wallace and Gromit out of clay, positioning them and photographing their actions one frame at a time. The result is a uniquely meticulous beauty, the fluid movements of ungainly little creatures. American moviegoers have experienced state-of-the-art stop-action animation in feature films like A Nightmare Before Christmas and the recent James and the Giant Peach. But as imaginatively executed as those were, they lack the humor and emotion that Park packs into his work. A Close Shave is the third Wallace and Gromit adventure. The action in this one involves our diffident, homebody heroes in the rescue of some kidnapped sheep who must be snatched from the paws of an evil cyborg bulldog. Nick Park is nothing if not a master of mixed genres. More importantly to Nick Park fans, however, this is the movie in which Wallace falls in love. In A Close Shave, Wallace and Gromit are making money by operating a window washing company, and Gwendolyn Ramsbottom hires them to clean the streaked, dingy panes of her store. For Wallace, a glimpse of the prim but pliant Gwendolyn is love at first sight. For a solitary tinkerer like Wallace, this is a staggering event, but one he handles with typical restraint. In a recent interview, Nick Park said that the inspiration for his little masterpiece here is the David Lean movie Brief Encounter, and that he wants to get at, quote, the idea of repressed, very English love. They say very little to each other, notes Park, but they say a lot at the same time, as you can hear in this bit of elliptical conversation.
I'm sorry about this.
For what?
Nothing. Just stay away from me, from my shop, and my silly, silly windows. Forget me. I'm no good for you.
Nick Park's films are very much English creations, work that has something of P.G. Wodehouse's whimsy and Henry Green's careful respect for middle-class banality. A Close Shave lasts a breathless, breathtaking 30 minutes. The other examples of Aardman animation in this anthology include My Baby Just Cares for Me, a clever illustration of a Nina Simone song, and Ident, a terribly pretentious, semi-abstract cartoon about masks and identity. But none of the others exhibit the ruthless economy of thought, detail, and wit that A Close Shave possesses with such deceptive effortlessness. This tiny movie deserves to be the summer's real blockbuster. Wallace may be a clay figure only 6 inches tall, but he's a more vivid human being than, say, Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. The Best of Aardman Animation is now playing in 12 cities, and this month will open in Chicago, Austin, and Minneapolis. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Barbara Bogave, and Louisa Shafia. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from William Morrow, publisher of Kenneth C. Davis's new book, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Everything You Need to Know About America's Greatest Conflict But Never Learned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.